This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to the podcast that takes a light-hearted look at lesser-known London stories with your own personal blue badge professional tourist guides.
She's Fiona.
And she's Alex.
And this is the Ladies Who London podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Ladies Who London podcast with me, Fiona Lucas,
and me, Alex Lazy.
Yay!
We've had
a freaky Friday style body swap thing. Hi, gang. How are you all doing? Are you healthy, Alex? Whoever you are.
Yes. I'm good.
Good.
Busy week, but always nice when you get to kind of get to the end of a busy week.
Yeah,
and
there's no more week left to be busy in.
Yes, yeah. But that's all right. How are you?
I am good. I'm loving the spring has started.
Oh gosh, yes.
I took the doglet out for a walk yesterday. We were just going to do a normal one. We ended up going for a walk for 3.5 hours because it's such a lovely day. And we just poodled all the way through Russia Docklands and round the river. And oh, it was great. We stopped for a coffee and I had a coffee and he tried to drink my coffee and it was all very lovely. And then we went out for another walk today and it honked it down with rain, but then actually cleared up a bit. So I love it when it gets to spring because there's hope. There's hope over the horizon. And the weather's getting better and all of that malarkey.
And the cherry blossom this year.
Oh my goodness. I don't think I've ever noticed it before. At least not in the numbers or the amount that it is this year. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Fabulous, isn't it?
And I think everyone's clearly got the sense that, I don't know, things are happening because this March is the busiest March I've ever known.
Yes.
Ever. Same
absolutely.
For you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same. And
absolutely
then it does, it gets quiet again in April. So it's not just March as the beginning of the season. I think it's the spring break. I've been around recently, so.
Yeah.
Lovely. I had a second Canadian school group this week who were a performing arts school and they were so enthusiastic about everything. Fabulous. I love them.
That's so nice. I love it when you get groups who've got a particular interest and they're just like, this is amazing! And you're like, something brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. And we walked a long way and they bless them, they didn't complain. They were getting slower and slower by the end. But they didn't
actually... like me on my walk yesterday.
Yeah. But we did, the last day I was with them, we did 22,000 steps.
Oh, gosh, that's a lot.
So, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going quite slowly as well.
Oh, my goodness.
By the end.
Talking of performing arts, I went to see, on Saturday the 16th, I went to see an amazing play, a one-man play with, now I never quite know how to say his name, it's either Billy Crudup or Billy Crudup.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not a sort of, if there's a play that comes out with a sleb in it, mm-hmm. I'm usually like, now, stay away. And they're going to win the Olivier anyway, just because they're famous, whether or not it's a good performance. But my friend just booked tickets. Went, I booked tickets to go and see a thing. Do you want to come? I was like, yeah, let's go see whatever thing. And we turned up. And he was magnetic. It was incredible. He played sort of 7 or 8 different characters all at the same time throughout. He was phenomenal. I think it's only on for about 9 weeks, but if you can get a ticket, it was great. It's called Harry Clark. And it's at the Ambassador's Theatre, which is the one that's right next to the Mousetrap, and which is just a beautiful, lovely little theatre. So it's quite intimate. And we were kind of penultimate row in the stalls and really close to the stage. It's lovely and small. It's where there's a great play there a couple of years ago called The Shark is Broken. So if anyone saw that, it's that little theatre there. But it was so good. And I didn't even know what I was seeing. I'd literally just said, in my diary it was, theatre with Lewis. And then turned up and was like, what are we seeing? No idea. And it was really, I didn't know anything about it. Very, very good show. So go and watch it, everyone.
Yeah.
Sometimes
it is nice to just take a kind of slightly potluck theatre.
Yeah.
Santa, my husband, as it were, he's every now and then he just goes to, like, if he's in town with time spare, go to like the Leicester Square Theatre or the Soho Theatre, because they have like quite short short runs and lots of changing, or things are on for a couple of like a day at a time and things, and it's like just potluck of whatever it is.
What have you got?
And
so love it. I love London for that. Right, well, any parish notices, any missives? I've got one, but have you got any?
Go for it.
All right.
I've got one too.
I have a lovely email from Alice, who is in the US, in New Jersey. I was contemplating there for a quick second doing an accent, but I'm not going to do that because, let's face it. And we're slightly too late on this, Alice. I'm so sorry. But we didn't spot it until after we recorded last week's episode. And she said, greetings from Fairhaven, New Jersey. My name is Alice. I'm a longtime lover of the pod. I lived in London last year as I worked on my MA in fine decorative art and design, and spent many journeys on the Northern Line. Oh, you poor thing.
Long journeys, I think. We've all had long journeys on the Northern
long,
Line.
Long, slow, delayed journeys on the Northern Line and listening along. I'm reaching out, hoping you might be able to wish my wonderful mum, Lauren, a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Lauren!
It's March the 17th, which is actually the day that we're recording this podcast.
Yay, so we're on the nose. Sorry, Lauren, but...
But we hope you had a fantastic day. Alice has said, I introduced her to the pod about 2 years ago. She's been an avid listener ever since. This is my favourite bit. While visiting me in London in December, she was absolutely beside herself when we stumbled upon the Broad Street pump. Yes, this is the level of nerdiness we love. Yes, Lauren and Alice, it's amazing. Well, Lauren, we hope you had a fantastic birthday. Sorry we're a bit late, but, you know, it's us. We're a bit behind the times on pretty much everything. So it wouldn't be...
Yeah, so if you do want us to do shout-outs for things, let us know a bit early, because also we do sometimes, we often record a few days ahead as well. So give us a bit more leeway and we'll...
Yeah, and we forget. Yeah. And generally... a rubbish everything. So if you do want anything, send missives by post, Instagram, email, carrier pigeon, as many times as you can, and one of us might remember to do it on the right date. But there we go. I hope you had a wonderful birthday, Lauren. Yay! Yeah.
And yesterday I was doing a Westminster tutorial out of the streets, and we went past the Broad Street pump and we spent a while standing around in various different, like, what's it like if we stand on the opposite pavement to talk about it? Or we cross over and stand around the pump. And so about 9 of us did what felt like it was going to turn into a little seance, kind of standing in a circle around the pump. And I was like,
there was someone sitting in the window of the pub watching them go,
what are they doing?
What is happening? What are these weirdos doing? Like, yep, that's us.
Yeah. And then just as we sort of moved slightly further away, another group came in and did the same thing again. People in the pub must be like, what?
Going on. That's so funny. You said you got an email to read out.
Yes, I have. And actually also lots of comments from last week, mostly people just saying, now I really want a cocktail. So yeah, fill your boots.
2 weeks
have
ago.
Cocktails.
Well, yes.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Yeah. Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Have cocktails. We should have a designated Ladies Who London cocktail hour, maybe like Friday at 7. Everyone has to. And even if you're not
wherever
in the UK, if it's like 2 in the afternoon, still do a cocktail. If you're in Australia, you know,
breakfast
gang
cocktails.
In Australia, like, yeah, breakfast cocktails. Why not? Let's do it.
Yeah, because if we do Friday night here, that'll be Saturday morning. That's the weekend in Australia.
Right?
Yeah.
Actually, I was on a Zoom with Dave, one of our Aussie listeners, on Saturday. We were all yuking away and it was like 11 o'clock and we were having a great time. He was like, right, I'm off to go and have a nice day. And we were like, oh yeah, we're going to go to bed.
Yeah.
We're like, what's it like tomorrow? Anyway,
lots of extra dragons. Since we've done the dragons, I keep seeing dragons.
Of course you do.
Including the one on the edge of Chinatown on Wardour Street. There's a fabulous Chinese dragon there.
Right, yeah.
And things. But Chris has been in touch to say...
Hi, Chris.
I was born in London, lived and worked there for 60 plus years, but moved out to commuter land. I'm learning lots from the podcast so far. Excellent listening. And he gave me some links, particularly for the Smithfield dragons.
Ooh,
and there are
lots
on Smithfield Meat Market. And Holborn Viaduct has very fine dragons.
Oh, they're beautiful. How do we forget those?
I think I realise actually there's just too many. Also, the monument has 4 on the top kind of corners of the square bit of the monument. So those, the city has a lot, but there's also dotted around. And the one I went to see today, which is one of those ones that, just after we did the dragon episode, I kept seeing references like 2 or 3 times in the next week. Things popped up about Lucky George.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Did we not? Yeah, of course, we forgot
so
Lucky George.
You might well have, because you did an episode about the Russell hotel. So yeah. I didn't go back and listen to it, but I'm guessing you might have covered Lucky George.
We definitely covered Lucky George. And I think actually Lucky George was the podcast pedestal. In fact, I feel like the podcast pedestal for that week was maybe Lucky George and Unlucky George. And those were the choices, okay. Possibly. Anyway. Yeah.
So I'm gonna put a thing on Instagram so for anyone who didn't listen to that episode, you can go back and listen to it, obviously. But as a brief recap, Lucky George is a dragon who lives on the stairs of the Russell Hotel. And the reason he's lucky is because he was one of a pair made by Fitzroy Dole, the architect, mm-hmm. who also designed the ballroom of the Titanic. And the other one of the pair was on the Titanic.
Ruh-roh.
So George is the survivor.
Yeah. Hence lucky.
So, yes. Yes.
Amazing.
So yeah, there's loads of dragons out there, and there are if anyone spots a dragon, obviously you can either tell us or tell Dragons of London, who are a website. Dragonsoflondon.org are hunting dragons across London, and people submit pictures. So if you see a dragon, take a picture, send it off to Dragons of London.
Fabulous.
And they will pop it on their website. And so if you want more, have a look there. They've got lots.
Lots of dragons. That's what we like.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for that. Right, well, let's get stuck into this week's episode. We have a guest this week, another guest, and we're treating you. And not just any old guest, a returning guest, and not just a returning guest from 2 weeks ago.
Yay!
Because Katie Wignall came in to chat to us about, well, we had our three different women for International Women's Day. International Women's Day?
International Women League.
Exactly. but we thought we would take up a bit more of her time than we deserved and get her to chat about one of her top tours, which is... Now, this is one that's probably not up everybody's street. And I have to say, it's pretty much the only thing that I don't guide, which is Jack the Ripper. However, Katie comes at it from a feminist point of view. And it comes at it from looking at the lives of the victims, putting the whole area into context and talking about the period at the time. So,
yeah, and I suppose I was going to think I'm coming from the opposite direction, because that was the thing that, one of the things that got me into guiding originally, is I started doing Jack the Ripper walks and then Big Bus and things, and it all kind of grew from there. Yeah. But equally, I don't do it anymore, but I did for a long time. Yeah. So
without further ado, let's get into this week's podcast and find out a little bit more about it. All right, podcast listeners, welcome to this week's episode. Now, Fiona and I have been threatening a guest for a few weeks, and we kept saying, there's a guest next week, and then it never was. This week, there is a guest. And Yay! Not only that, she's right here with us now. So welcome back to the podcast, Katie from Look Up London. Hello.
Hello. Fabulous. Welcome. Thanks for having me back.
So who are we going to chat about this week?
Well, I guess this could be fairly controversial. I don't know. But the women that we're going to talk about this week are not particularly noteworthy for their lives. They didn't achieve great things. But I think they're an important part of history. And they're actually the group together because they are known as the five victims from a serial killer who became known as Jack the Ripper. But the aim of today isn't to talk about him, but to talk about their stories and also some other inspiring East End women as well.
Because it's often the case that when people come to London and often really bizarrely student tour groups love doing Jack the Ripper tours. And
yeah, it's one of the first things I get asked if people find out I'm a tour guide. They say, oh, like the Jack the Ripper tours.
Yeah. And I have to say, it's the one thing I do not guide. Oh, yeah, I mean, I guess everyone loves... I mean, all you have to do is look at the amount of true crime and all that sort of stuff. See, people love a murder. They love a, you know...
I think for school groups as well, it makes perfect sense because it's something that the teachers think will appeal to the students. It's quite often in the evening. It's cheaper than the theatre. It keeps them busy for an hour and a half of an evening. It's from the teacher's point of view, it's a really logistically a good... thing to do.
And I think families and things like, I mean, on the face of it, perhaps not knowing much about it, they think, oh, what will teenagers be interested? And sadly, people think kind of, oh, blood and guts and spooky horror stories. So that is kind of what people think, you know, people will be interested in. I think, although that is true, and there's nothing wrong with liking true crime, obviously, I think it, you know, it kind of doesn't give teenagers and other people full credit. They can be interested in lots of other things.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that until people have done it, they don't really know what the story is. And people quite often kind of go away going, so like, you know, it's less obviously entertainment once you've finished doing the walk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, at the end of my tour, I often say, I feel weird saying, I hope you enjoyed the tour.
Yeah.
Because lots of it is actually really fairly depressing.
Yeah. And often it's funny because I think people don't always think that Jack the Ripper and his story was a real one. Some people think James Bond was real and Jack the Ripper was not, and it's completely the other way around.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting.
And people go, and Dick Whittington.
It's a great story. Oh, Dick Whittington, yeah.
He's another.
It's a great story, but it's not real, is it? And you're like, yeah, no, it absolutely is real.
I contend that Jack the Ripper is a fictional character. There were some murders.
That's true.
And there is the fictional character of Jack the Ripper, which the media and the people and the thing invented.
But there was still a real person behind it.
Yes.
Yeah. But given that it's International Women's Day, we're not talking about Jack the Ripper and the murders in that sense. We're not going full in on that today, are we? We're taking a completely different angle. And this is an angle that you do very effectively in your walking tours, which is the kind of the feminist angle. To the Jack the Ripper
stories. I started offering the feminist Jack the Ripper tour in 2019, and it's been really popular. It's a tour that I love doing, and actually now I do a lot for student groups who are looking for a more humanizing take on the story. That doesn't glorify the violence against women.
So give us a bit of a background then into the into the women and how you approach it.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, just in case people don't know anything about the whole subject, it's worth putting in a bit of context. So in the year of 1888, 8 women were violently killed in and around the area of Whitechapel. And these murders were very shocking because they escalated in terms of violence. Few of them happened in close succession and they were all in the same area. And it coincided with the kind of newness of the police. They'd only been introduced in 1829, and with the invention of the telegraph in 1870, and this rise of mass media and an interest and appetite for stories. So all of these things coexist. We also have the context of an incredibly impoverished area of London, Whitechapel, part of the East End, which is right on the doorstep of the city of London, which is at this point the heart of the British Empire, the biggest the world's ever seen, and one of the wealthiest places in the whole world. So there are a lot of elements that are in the background of this. Yeah. In terms of the 8 women who were murdered, 5 of them we know quite a bit about because most people, I say in inverted commas, believe that they were killed by this person called Jack the Ripper. Now, this person was never caught. There was never really a proper trial, proper case. And so it's been this unsolved mystery that has attracted reams and reams of books published since 1929. That was when the first book was published. But all of these women, and it's hard, because what I try to do is see them as individuals, but their lives mirror each other in a few ways. None of them really were born in the East End, but because of a mixture of no safety net for them, of bad choices in their lives, of dependency on alcohol, of fleeing domestic violence and other things, they ended up in Whitechapel. And actually, Hallie Reubenhold, who many people will know, wrote an incredible book called The Five. She says Jack the Ripper might have killed these women, but it's Victorian society that was the accomplice. Mm. And I think we've talked about the East End
so much and how abject things were. I mean, we look back at some of the podcasts we've done, like the Match Girls and all this kind of thing. And,
same year, July, 1888, exactly, and the same time that
we've talked about how abject the conditions were for those women and girls who worked there, and it's incredible. And again, we've spoken a lot about strong East End women, and I say East End, whether they started out life in the East End or whether they came to live there, but the East End engenders a particular type of woman that just has to be strong and resilient and, you know, as powerful as she can be in order to survive. It's just a survival technique.
Those might be the ones that we read about.
Yeah, and there will be tons of others that were just, you know, but I think even when you look into that, I would say that there were probably very, very few East End women who didn't have a career, for example, because they had to.
Yes.
You know, you don't have, and I think any woman who is in the East End in the, 15, 16, 17, 1800s and is surviving through having a career, through having whatever, they've got to be a certain type of woman. They've got to be, strong to survive. So whether we know about them or not, I feel like it's sort of baked into the DNA of the East End.
It reminds me of I forget her name, the writer that you had on writes so wonderfully, particularly about sort of wartime women. Something that I speak about at the beginning of the tour is this idea of the East End woman, and particularly in 1888 and around that time, you know, the East End, people were obsessed with it. I don't think that's too strong a word. You know, there's all these pamphlets. People are kind of enamored is too strong, because really they're just, it's like documentaries today, like true crime documentaries. Mm. There was this whole industry based around slumming and of middle class people going to have a look at how the other half lived. You know, in the 1870s, you could hire a slum omnibus and go on a tour looking at the East End and how these people lived. And so to a certain extent, and it's something I'm conscious of and try not to, you know, play too much into, but there is this otherness of the East End. And I don't really know why. A lot could be said about the different ways of immigrant communities. People incessantly talk about it's all foreign shops and foreign talk and foreign places. But people are fascinated with this other world, you know, that's so different to the comfortable, nice place that they live. And I think that is a backdrop. You know, when people see in the news reports, Mary Ann Nichols was an East End woman, Catherine Eddowes was an East End woman, you know, they might have only lived there a year, but they're grouped, they're lumped together into something that people associate with this idea of the East End.
And as well, towards the end of the Victorian period particularly, they were starting to get all philanthropic, weren't they? And a little bit I don't want to say making themselves feel better by trying to do good stuff, but essentially there's an element of that, isn't there? And they all start to kind of do that. Oh, we need to do this to help the East End, and we need to do that and this, and clothe the children and feed the people and educate people. And so there's, I guess, in a way, like you're right, that fascination they didn't always do the best thing for the people. You know, it wasn't always necessarily completely altruistic. But yeah, you're right. There's that obsession where they were something
I think you can see, I mean, by and large, all of the philanthropy that was going there was, even at the time, you know, well-meaning. But certainly, I think we can see it with a bit of a pinch of patronising.
Mm, yeah.
Patronising sense, perhaps. And this idea of the middle-class person swooping in to save the working class.
I was just looking up what date the poverty maps were. You know, Charles Booth is 1890, late 90s, I think. Yeah. But that idea to kind of really try and map London and see how bad things are, where things are worst, and, you know, get a sort of scientific approach to it as well, is around about that same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, I mean, you know, it's in never in any way going to justify the murder of 8 women, but some maybe tactless commentators are like, well, it cleaned up the East End, you know, it helped. People literally
Great.
Write that, you know.
Yeah.
I'm talking in like previous novels.
Of course.
An interesting book that was helpful for me was this book here, which is called The Ripper's Victims in Print by Rebecca Frost. And it's fascinating because she charts from 1929 until when this was published in 2017, all of the books that had been written about Jack the Ripper and how they talk about the women.
Ah,
interesting.
Yeah.
And she was interested in this in the context of a wider discussion, you know, of how we talk about serial killers, the obsession with these geniuses that get away, you know, with it, and how we talk about the women. And it's interesting, what she thought that she'd find is that there would be a general constant steady movement towards the humanization of the murdered women. And then on the next line, she said, that is not what I found.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's not all completely dehumanizing, but more or less they are vessels to tell the story of who the murderer is rather than individuals in their own sense. And there's several themes, you know, people come to when they're talking about them.
So where would you start then with, so you mentioned 8 women.
Yeah. Well, I think something that's quite nice to do is just name and list all of the women so we can sort of think about them. So we have Emma Smith, who was 45 years old. She died on the 3rd of April. Martha Tabram, who was 39. She died on the 7th of August. Mary Ann, also known as Polly Nichols, who was 43. She died on the 31st of August. Annie Chapman, who was 47. She died on the 8th of September. Catherine Eddowes, who was 48. And Elizabeth Stride, who was 43. And they both died on the 30th of September. Mary Jane Kelly, who was 25. Who died on the 9th of November, and Rose Milet, who is 29 and died on the 20th of December.
And when we talk about Jack the Ripper and his victims, we tend to talk about what's referred to as the canonical 5, which are the kind of 5 in the middle. So 2 at the front and 1 at the end aren't normally. So Martha Tabram, Emma, and I can't remember the last.
Rose Milet.
Rose Milet tend not to be included in that. Why is that?
sometimes I think it's about the gap in the timing. Also, it's in the way that some of the women were murdered. Martha Tabram was stabbed numerous times, 39 times, but doesn't have the hallmarks of Jack the Ripper. Emma Smith, I just want to touch on, and I don't know if the top you might want to put a trigger warning of this, because in general the victims weren't sexually assaulted, but Emma Smith, there is a sexual violence, because she was attacked by 3 men, one of these vigilante gangs that used to kind of walk around targeting sex workers in the East End in a bid to sort of clean up the streets. And she was so violently attacked, she went back to her lodging house, and the woman there in charge sent her to the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel.
Warning, the next section includes details of what happened to her. If you don't want to hear this, fast forward 20 seconds.
And she had been assaulted, her earring had been ripped out, and a blunt instrument had been forced inside her, and she died of her injuries to her internal organs the next day. It's something that I weigh up whether to tell on the tours, because it's so horrific. And I mean, you know, I get emotional talking about it because she could have been anyone, really. Mm. But I think she's Emma Smith, you know, she was a real person. She deserves for that awful crime to be recognised against her.
Yeah, absolutely.
The police on duty kind of did try to investigate it, but no witnesses came forward. People did not think it necessary to report it to the police.
Goodness me.
So, yeah. You can see why at the end I'm like, I hope you enjoyed the tour.
Yeah.
Wasn't this a really fun outing?
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to talk about.
But do you on the tour generally, so I should say I've been on your tour. I think I did come on and you did it, and then also I've also led it once or twice. And generally you don't talk much about the women's murders. Is that true for
I do try to focus on their lives rather than how they ended, because you know that information is out there if people want to want to find it.
And so tell us a bit about these women then. I mean, it's always the truth that's always out there is that they were East End women, they were all sex workers, and that none of them were ever sort of going to be missed. But that's far from the truth, isn't it? Like you said about them being lumped together, it's very much that's the sort of thing that they've been lumped together as well.
Yeah, and actually they're wildly different in many ways. I mean, so Polly Nichols, who's kind of official name is Mary Ann Nichols, she was born in 1845 and she lived off Fleet Street in like a little court off Shoe Lane. Mm-hmm. And she kind of moved around in lots of different positions, in lots of different housing in and around Fleet Street. But her father was a blacksmith. And she later would marry William Nichols, who was a printer. And it's funny you mentioned about the Great Exhibition before. So he worked for the printers that produced the catalogue for the Great Exhibition.
So he had got this really upstanding.
Yeah, I guess it was the thing in the Victorian age, wasn't it? Yeah. So there's always links. So Polly Nichols. You know, Polly and William were married at St. Bride's Church in Fleet Street at the Journalist
fabulous.
Church in 1864. And really, in a really nice touch, actually, I don't know when it was unveiled, maybe 2 years ago, the vicar at St. Bride's Church has unveiled a plaque. You can go inside St. Bride's Church now and find a plaque of Polly Ann Nichols. Mm-hmm. And it says, remember her life, not her death.
That's so lovely.
On the plaque, yeah, no mention of anything else. So, you know, in many ways, Polly's life, she kind of had things going for her. She was married. Her and William had three children at this point, and then they were given a lifeline. You know, they were given a Peabody house. So yeah. George Peabody, the great philanthropist, who'd made his money in the city, he pushed so much money, I think it's something like £150,000 in the 19th century into housing. And so they move into this apartment with four rooms. They have another child and they have a few good years there, but the marriage breaks down. And at this point in history, you know, divorce is incredibly rare. Mm. The laws had only just been changed, I think, in the 1850s. And men could divorce their wives if there was adultery, but women, to divorce their husbands, they had to prove adultery and cruelty or desertion or something else. So it was already, you know, harder for a woman to leave. And they couldn't reconcile really their differences. William said that she was drinking too much, which alcohol affects a lot of these the women's lives. And in the end, you know, she does actually leave. They end up having five children. You know, one is only tiny, and Polly walks out, which is a, you can't imagine that emotional toll, that decision. And you could paint it as like a really reckless, you know, uncaring thing to do, that she's just an alcoholic and she marches out. But she says she was concerned about their neighbour, Rosetta. And after she's moved out, Rosetta and William move in together.
I've been reading that in the book and thinking, oh, yeah. This is so...
I think he waits 6 months to remarry Rosetta after she died. So, yeah, what a nice guy.
And also,
actually,
I think
this
In that period of time, if you were to get divorced or split up, then the status would be that the man would get the kids anyway. So I suppose...
Yeah. You are the property of your husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that usually goes with the children. Most of the women did have children. I mean, sometimes, like in the case with Catherine Eddowes. So Catherine Eddowes was born in Wolverhampton, in the Midlands. And as a baby, she was taken down to London. And I think, gosh, her parents had something like 12 children. She was one of 12 children. And, you know, she saw two of her very young siblings die when they were only months old. She was young herself, but still, you've got to soak up that trauma as a child. Mm. And then she was sent back up because her mother died when she was 13. Her father died when she was 15. And then she's sent back up to her. I know, it's awful. And these,
and like you said, there's no lifelines, there's no safety nets, is there? So
no, just... and her aunts are kind of, they don't really know what to do with her. And it's interesting because Catherine, so she's also known as Kate Eddowes, she had been sent to quite a posh primary school in Bermondsey, kind of like Tooley Street area. And actually, I looked this up recently. This will probably only be of interest to you two. her parents, and when she was very young, they lived in Baden's Place, Crosby Row, which is the Guild of Tourist Guides is now based.
That's interesting.
By London Bridge. Isn't that bonkers? Yeah. Anyway, so she, my favourite thing about Kate is that when she was in this primary school, and I don't know why she was sent there, it's not clear, but she clearly as a young child was very charismatic and showed a lot of promise, because I think she liked being the centre of attention. She was nicknamed Chick because she had this lovely singing voice, and you get a sense that she was a bit of the class clown, and, you know, she'd always be entertaining everyone. So, you know, as I said, her mother dies when she's around 13, her father at 15. She's sent back up to the Midlands, and she's literally gets given this job in a factory, kind of polishing tin. And she's like, this, no, it's not for me.
And it feels like it's, you know, to some, it's seen as being quite a good job, isn't it?
Yeah,
but it's like her
solid.
Relatives kind of get the, you know, get her in, and it's good and things, and it's just clearly not for her. And
she runs off with an Irishman, shock horror.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's exciting. And she's on the road with him, a man called Thomas Conway.
Good for her.
And they travel. Yeah. And I mean, you get this sense that, you know, like anyone's lives, there are good bits and there are bad bits. And does perhaps seem quite romantic. She actually has a tattoo, TC. For his initials. And you can look at this two ways, you know, because this is quite romantic maybe in one sense, but also
maybe ownership.
Later he becomes quite violent. Her sister talks about him giving her black eyes. So is that a brand? Is that, you know, the problem
adorable.
Is we have such scant information that it's really hard to know for sure, you know, these things.
But it does seem as well like she you know, they're tramping around and things, but aren't they? They're writing and selling pamphlets and things, aren't they? For a sort of, you know, at the gallows, those sort
ballads,
of pamphlets,
yeah.
ballads.
Yeah,
ballads. No. Seems like Kate's.
Yeah, that's their main thing.
That's she's much more hands on with that than Thomas is.
It's really hard to say. You know, how this work gets divided. Hallie speculates, you know, that perhaps Kate has written some of these ballads herself. But the pair of them certainly they're peddlers. They go up and down the country and they sell whatever they can. And something that's very popular are these, ironically for her, the end of her life. You know, they're gruesome tales about murders that have been committed up and down the country, and they sell these ballads at public executions.
Goodness.
And, you know, even more ironic is they go to one of her own distant cousins. He is being executed murdering his fiance. Yeah, isn't that bonkers?
And so she can do the sort of inside scoop with him, in a way. She's got the, you know, the edge on the other people selling versions.
It's it's extraordinary. So 1866, this you know, quite a young guy, I think he's only in his late teens or early 20s, Charles Robinson, he is found guilty of murdering his fiancée, a woman called Harriet Seeger. And Charles Robinson is one of Kate's cousins there, and they're in the crowd. And it's just, it's so ironic.
Weird.
It's so odd.
I always find it very odd, the way that executions were attended and enjoyed and, you know, were a part of society. I mean, it's just completely at odds to what we're like here in the UK today. But it did happen. And that's what people, I always refer to it as the Netflix of the Middle Ages. Well, the Middle Ages
totally.
Are later.
And I kind of think if they brought it back, which I hope they never do, obviously, there would be
there'd be crowds
of people there.
Yeah.
Huge crowds.
Yeah.
Not me. I'm squeamish. But,
yeah. You know. No, I'm opting out of that.
No. But, you know, there is, like we said, you know, with Kate, I think there is, there's good bits to their lives. There are moments where they're really happy. And there's also, like, humorous parts of their lives, like, you know, like anyone's lives. And one of the humorous elements, you might say, it's kind of like tragically funny, but for me, like, Kate as this young girl who sort of craves attention, you know, she's often then arrested when she's drinking in and around Whitechapel, you know, for causing, being drunk and disorderly, you know, for being that person who's drawn a small crowd because she's singing in the street and people would recognize her. And on the night, on the 30th of September, you know, she's, in some reports it says that she was impersonating a fire engine's bell.
Yeah, yes.
And you just think, like, oh, like, and it is funny. I mean, but it's also, you know, tragic because you know how it ends.
Yeah.
But
that's what I think my aim in talking more about the women is not to paint them as, you know, saints or, you know, a certain type of woman. It's just to present them as more well-rounded characters than just basically a few lines in a footnote to someone else's story.
Absolutely. Do you want to talk about some more of the victims, or do you want to talk about some other East End women?
I think one of the most enigmatic figures actually is Elizabeth Stride, or as I should say, she was born Elizabeth Gofsterdotter because she was Swedish. And in many ways, you know, fits right in with the story of the East End and all these different immigrant communities that were making the home in London and in the East End. So she arrives in London in about the 1860s. And again, she gets married in a church that we'll be familiar with, St. Giles in the Fields.
Oh, my friend got married there.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. So it's beautiful no church together. And it built 17.
But the wedding was lovely.
It was. I was bridesmaid. We sang in the choir. It was great.
We actually...
And then I have to tell you, when we went into St. John's... So when we went into the garden where they have, like, you know, champagne drinks afterwards, St. Charles is very good. They've got quite an outreach programme for homeless guys in the area. But basically, like... We had all the drinks in the garden and all these homeless guys were just wandering in and grabbing glasses of champagne. And the vicar was having nice. Sort of go and be like, it's sort of a private thing. It was so funny. I think he had to shoo some of that at the church at the start of the wedding. There's a guy snoring on the seat at the back. Of the
You know, maybe that is like a rip in space and time, because I think later, like, Elizabeth Stride would definitely try her luck.
Almost
and would
certainly.
Like she would be having a slice of cake and she would be having as many glasses of champagne as she could get her hands
yeah.
on.
Yeah, yeah. So and she'd say, no, I'm the bride's side. Yeah. And then later, you know, no, I'm on the groom's family. I'm groom's cousin.
Yeah. So in case people so what's interesting about Elizabeth Stride and to a certain extent Mary Jane Kelly as well, and I think this is something that, you know, if you're not born in an area, I think you might get into the habit of just making up stories about yourself because it's safer and there's a sense of leaving a past behind you. Mm. And certainly Elizabeth yeah. Stride does this to the extent that people don't actually know that she's Swedish, which you
really?
Just, yeah. I just find amazing. So not many people attend her funeral, sadly, but not many people comment, friends or people that had come across her comment on the fact that she was Swedish, you know, when the police are going around asking questions.
She does yeah. have, doesn't she have a book? She has a Swedish, is it a Bible or just a book?
A prayer
in,
book,
I can't remember.
I think.
A prayer book in Swedish. And there was two sort of thoughts put forward as to why she still had it. One is that it obviously has sentimental attachment kind of to her, or just that in Whitechapel there isn't a lot of market for a Swedish prayer book, so it wasn't valuable enough to sell. And both of those are quite kind of touching possibilities in a way.
And this is the problem with, you know, having these almost bullet points of a life, is that you can interpret them
yeah.
you know different ways. She also spoke a bit of Yiddish, apparently. She worked as a domestic servant for quite a lot of Jewish families in the area. So she just seems like this quite amazing woman who was able to, you know, fit in with whatever surroundings.
No, I was going to say, she ran a pub, did she? Or she was married, I haven't thought about it for a while.
And John, it wasn't a pub. That might have actually been the problem. It was a coffee house.
Okay.
And
there we go.
They tried to set up various ones around the East End and actually in different places in London. And I think one of them was on East India Dock Road, you know, sort of pushing mm-hmm. for the sailor trade. And sailors, I think, famously prefer beer to
coffee.
I think a coffee house, well, I suppose there are various iterations of coffee houses over the years. It kind of first comes in 1650s, and as well as selling coffee, there are also these almost like networking places, these places where you can get the latest news, and they're quite bustling, they're really kind of exciting places. I think into the 19th century there was a big move for coffee, cocoa, tea houses as the antidote to the pub or yeah. the music hall, as a place where you could get food and sustenance and non-alcoholic beverages as a kind of, you know,
wholesome.
Say a big place for business, and there were quite a lot of very famous coffee houses where, yeah, that would happen. Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, they tried a few times and they basically gave up in 1874. John and they never have any children, John and Liz, but they sort of see each other on and off, but they basically separate. And actually, John dies from a heart condition in 1884, so 4 years before Elizabeth. One of the stories that Elizabeth tells, which I think we, you know, it is a lie, but I think we can accept that people are pretty desperate in this situation of now living hand to mouth in the East End, relates to the Princess Alice disaster.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. You guys heard about this ship. So Princess Alice was like a pleasure cruiser boat that took people along the River Thames. And it's this is in 1878. And it collided with another ship on the Thames and 650 people died, which is a crazy amount. Mm. And they didn't have a full list, a passenger list of everyone on the ship. And so in some of the poorest areas of London, you know, the City of London are like, was anyone on the ship? You can get compensation. Can you imagine? You know, Elizabeth Stride is like, oh, I've got a good idea. There. So it's quite funny, really. She puts in a claim and she says that her, John, and their seven children were on board.
My goodness.
And you're like, just go for broke. Go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, if, yeah. Yeah. Did it work?
And it, no, denied. <the claim. laughs> But, you know, it's also a story that she tells lots of other people as a way to garner sympathy and possibly get money, you know, off right. people in the streets. Like I say, you know, I think fair play to her to yeah. try and to try and get
a,
that.
I'm sure many, many.
Exactly, but this is yeah, one of the kind of stories. She actually was interviewed. Again, it's tricky. I assume it was the same kind of Elizabeth Stride, but she was interviewed apparently by Dr. Bernardo. So one of these, outreach, philanthropic-minded people who were trying to save the East End. And she told him the Princess Alice story as well, but she's changed it. Yeah, you know, if it worked, it must have worked a few times to get some money.
Yeah, some people must have got lucky in that because there's no way they're going to be able to fact check that, are they? If they haven't got a passenger list. Oh,
no, 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 no. Exactly. I just briefly want to mention as well Annie Chapman because I think, I don't know if you felt this, Fiona, reading the book, but in many ways,
I tell you what,
it's
reading...
so frustrating, her story.
It is, yeah, but
I've read that as well, and I'm yeah.
I led Jack the Ripper walks for years. It's how I got into guiding, and I sat on the tube reading about Annie Chapman, and I thought I was talking about the women, you know, quite a fair bit in terms of what I knew about them and what I thought the research was, or, you know, what knowledge was out there about them. I thought I was doing a kind of decent job. And then I just sat on the tube and read about Annie's childhood and it's cried
something
and
else.
haven't done Jack the Ripper's really since then. And what you were saying about Kate's siblings dying, but I haven't got it in front of me. I didn't check the kind of details of it, but Annie Chapman's, there's what, two or three siblings die in very quick succession. And then a bit later on, her father commits suicide. And it's just, and you just think, oh my God, no, yeah. no wonder she had a difficult life. You know,
some people just do yeah. not get a break from the very start. And she's one of them. And it's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But then in a way she does get a break. She gets married. Her husband's working as a coachman in a nice, respectable household, you know, quite well, sort of high society-ish kind of things. And she was drinking a lot, but then she gives up and she goes without drinking for a year or so, something maybe even more like that. And then there is an occasion, and they don't have drink in the house, but there's an occasion when somebody's coming to visit. So they buy a bottle of whiskey for someone to come and visit. And then she has a bit of that and then is kind of off the wagon. And it's just so close, you know.
Yeah. There's an alternative. This is the thing with like the different stories, you know, that get passed down. A version of the whiskey story is actually that her husband, who is pretty good, you know, really resents her drinking, but I think really loves her, really wants her to get better. He's ill. So before he goes to work, he has like a bit of whiskey and a hot drink with like honey and lemon.
Okay.
And as she kisses him goodbye to go to work, she like tastes it on him.
Oh.
And then it like spirals downhill. And again, this story is sort of retold from different people she spoke to. It could be apocryphal, but
yeah,
you get a sense of how these women lived, really on a knife edge. Like Annie had three children, and their oldest daughter Emily died aged 12 from meningitis. And I think sometimes we're guilty in history of being like, oh well, children died early all the time, and you're like,
yeah,
the pain was no less.
It doesn't make it any easier.
We're all the same humans, you know. It's that is catastrophic for anyone, not least somebody who's kind of now living hand to mouth, has separated with her husband like cannot deal with her being drunk in public because it's not the done thing. And so she sent away all of her family and like teetotal because of what happened with her father. So they don't want her around.
Doesn't her brother is slightly less teetotal than the others. So there's a sort of, you know.
Yeah. And they, again, there's this story that they run into each other and he's doing quite well for himself. And this, you can imagine the awkwardness of this situation. You know, his older sister is quite haggard at this point. She's living on the street, sometimes homeless. She possibly has tuberculosis at this point, and he gives her some money, but he doesn't want to make a big deal out of it because he doesn't want his other siblings to know that he's kind of, you know, given in.
Yeah.
And he's quite smartly dressed and is trying to make a better life for himself. And you know, you can imagine the interaction on the commercial street, you know.
Yeah. Just such a... there are so many points in the stories of all of the women where things could have been vastly different if it were not for one small decision or one tiny turn of fate that would have sent them on a different direction. You know, that classic thing of the tiniest of movements at the start, when you go down the road, the forks are completely far apart. It's that exact thing. And it is heartbreaking. But then, I mean, if it weren't them, it would have been somebody else, because clearly whoever it was, you know, it wasn't about these particular women. It was about any victim, basically. But yeah. But I think, like you say, it's really important to talk about them and to put it into context. And that story that we often hear about, oh well, nobody missed them, they were just, and in fact most of them, I think, isn't it that they're always said that they're all sex workers, and actually most of them weren't, or at least if they were, it was very occasional. It wasn't, you know, it was more in a case of, and
this is a very like messy nuanced subject as well. I mean, still, unfortunately, anyone, you know, involved in the sex trade, I think I read you it something like 18 times more likely to be a victim of violence and maybe murder. You know, if you're involved in that, it still has so much stigma attached to it. And really the point I try to get across on tours is that it shouldn't matter the women, if it was all the time, if it was occasionally, it was never. You know, it doesn't take away from any aspect of their humanity.
But I think what I mean by saying, you know, that they were sort of incorrectly labelled as sex workers is not, again, not to denigrate in any way, because as you all know, I'm very much, you know, not that kind of person. But it's, again, it's that lumping together and that thing of saying they're all the same. They've all got this in common. They all do this. And again, that othering of, particularly back then, it was very much seen as, well, they are part of this group of people and therefore not worthy of our whatever, you know, support or our pity, anything like that. But they weren't. They were, and like you say, well,
we're talking about their stories, they're all very individual. They've got their own stories, their own backgrounds, their own, you know, where they're from, what their status in life is. They're the only thing that really marks them out as being, you know, together in a group is their ends. And it's really important to kind of talk about them as individual entities.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, like going back to Rebecca Frost's book, when she, you know, charts how people have talked about them, it is a convenient way that people throughout history, and unfortunately still today, find it palatable to, you know, to ignore the fact that they're individual human women. Because if they're, you know, just sex workers, then it's okay to talk about the murders and disregard them. And thankfully, I think that has become, you know, as horrendous a statement as, you know, it should be to us today.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's sort of tempting to go, oh yeah, that, you know, back in 1888, that was the way it was done. But there's a lot of more recent similar things which were treated in a very similar way. You know, the sort of the Yorkshire Ripper. Again, same kind of nickname given, which had a similar sort of feel to it.
Yeah. And again, there has just been a TV series called The Long Shadow all about... well, they haven't actually referred to him as the Yorkshire Ripper, which then the victims' families are very happy about. But again, in that, you do see them saying they're all sex workers and people kind of almost disregarding them because of that. And some of the characters are saying, sorry, like, I'm not having that. Like, it doesn't matter whether they were sex workers or not. It doesn't matter what they do. They are still women, murdered women who deserve our work to, you know, find out who it is and bring them to justice. So you're right, it's still an ongoing problem.
Totally. As you said, Fiona, something that occasionally I'll read out is during the trial in the 1980s, the prosecutor, the Attorney General Sir Michael Havers, said that while some of the victims were prostitutes, perhaps the saddest part of this case is that some were not.
Yeah, it's just...
And, you know, quite rightly got absolutely hounded. You know, people were up in arms, which 100 years previously, people could say things like that in the press and there wasn't as outrage. But he still said it in the 1980s.
You know? It shows the attitudes.
So thankfully now the reaction is that
that's
is
reprehensible. That's not acceptable,
Yeah.
Interesting. Katie, thanks so much for coming along to talk about this. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I feel like it's been very, very dark. And
I'm so sorry. You know,
yeah, we'll just invite you on for the things like the really sad stuff, the real stuff that's going to make us really blue. But no, it's been really interesting.
I do talk about fun stuff as well, I promise.
No, she doesn't. No, she doesn't, gang. But no, it's been brilliant. So thank you so much. And if anybody wants to join one of Katie's walks, she does Feminist Jack the Ripper walks, which Fiona also runs for her and a variety of other people. Is there anything else you'd like to mention while we're here?
Oh, yes. I do actually have a fun map, which is just being published on International Women's Day, called Women's History London Map. And you can buy it online. And it's kind of a fold-out big A3 map with 50 different women, including some of the Ladies Who London favourites, Noor and Ayat Khan.
Yay.
I think Elizabeth Fry might be on there that you just listed. And all of the statues, you know, for Sarah Siddons and places like that. And also some plaques that of women that you might not have heard of, and, you know, mentions the Match Girls and all sorts of things like that. So some uplifting women's stories as well.
So is that via your website, or where would people go to find that?
It's actually Blue Crow. It's published by Blue Crow Media. So if you go on their website, they have all different fabulous maps. Including some London Tube ones that would be up your street.
Yes. I was going to say, are they the ones that they've done sort of green spaces as well?
Whole host of different beautiful maps. Amazing. So yeah, I've written this one on women's history.
Fantastic.
Fabulous.
Lovely. Thanks so much, Katie. We'll get you back on again, I'm sure. Good luck with the map. And we'll speak to
Thank
you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Katie, for coming back and doing another great episode. I think it's a really interesting way of looking at the whole story because, you know, like you say, you started out guiding by doing Jack the Ripper tours, and then they're known in the guiding industry as I'm doing a Ripper tonight.
Oh, really? I always did Jack. I'm doing Jack.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, I just hear everyone saying, oh, can anyone do a Ripper? Is anyone free for a Ripper on that night? And I don't know, it's just become such a sort of a thing that it's always felt so uncomfortable to me that I just never wanted to do it.
Round about the time when I was doing less of them, I did get a request one time for a walk that was me, ghosts and Jack the Ripper. Mm. I was like, no, that's not. Because the ghosts are, okay, they may be ghosts.
Careful how you tread.
But maybe some of them are more kind of elaborate stories.
There's an element of fiction in there.
There may be some exaggeration or something about them. And, you know, the other is Grizzly Murders. And it was like, no, those two things. I'm not doing those two things together. That's not the right combo.
Yeah.
So.
And as well, there is a lot of people who do the Rippers and they're very sensationalist. And I think, you know, like we said in the episode, people are really interested in true crime, but it just never quite sat right with me that I was going out and making money from. I mean, of course, the things you mention in tours, and there's always, you know, stuff like that. And I do a tour on Crime and Punishment and all of that. But I don't know. I think something that's become so sensationalised that it's hard to wade through what's real and what's not is just always felt a bit uncomfortable to me.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's the thing that is interesting about it.
No shade on anybody who does them at all. It's just, it was never something for me that I wanted to do or to kind of engage in.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right.
Okay, yeah, good to see that there's different ways of doing it now. So there's options.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of, you know, so that's all, yeah.
Well, that's it for next week. For this week. So for next week, I'm getting ahead of myself. That's it forever.
Bye.
But next week, you're treated to our live episode, which is happening this coming week, which has come around so fast. It's been so long going, oh, it's happening in 2 months. We're like, yeah. And then we're going, oh, God, it's happening in 4 days
week.
Or whatever. 3 days? Oh, my goodness. No, hang on. Yeah, 4 days. 3 days? Oh, I don't even know. Anyway, soon. It's happening soon. which is a bit scary, but it's going to be great and I can't wait to see loads of people, and I think we're pretty much sold out now. There might be one or two tickets left if you are hanging around and fancy it, and frankly, you know, Lauren and Alice, if you don't come over from America for it, then are you even fans?
Yeah.
I'm so mean, aren't I? Alright, my loves, we will see you next week. Have a great week.
Bye.
Thank you.